My name is Liz Joyner. I'm the executive director of the Village Square, and on behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, I'd like to welcome you tonight to Media Wars, the future of how and what we know. Tonight's program was made possible by the generous support of Ron Sachs Communications. Anyone who knows Ron and his team, which are giveaway. Anyone who knows Ron and his team knows that he's at the heartbeat of both this community and our state, and we could not have done it without them. Thank you so very much. We also want to thank the FSU College of Social Sciences and Public Policy Laird B. Anderson and Florence H. Ashby Lectureship on Public Policy Journalism. We're honored that tonight Laird and Florence are here all the way from Rockville, Maryland. If you guys don't mind giving a wave and standing up. You get the award for coming farthest tonight. No, maybe John Harwood does. It's a toss-up. The Anderson Ashby Lectureship sponsors a series of must-see lectures on public policy journalism with speakers like Paul Steiger of ProPublica, David Sanger of the New York Times, Roger Mudd, and today John Harwood. We thank them for bringing him here tonight, and thanks to John Mayo and Joan, wherever you are, for all of your work in getting this done. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you Misquote and the Clarifications. Misquote's role will be sung by Roseanne Dunkelberger, otherwise known as the editor of Tallahassee Magazine, and all the clarifications you need will be provided by Christopher Manuel. Am I pronouncing that correct, Christopher? Where are you? Who is on the faculty at Stubbs Music School, plays with Exit 199, the Dorian Q, and other Tallahassee bands. Misquote and the Clarifications lyricist is Florence Snyder. I'm losing people. Florence Snyder is somewhere in this room, an attorney and columnist for Florida Voices and a featured blogger for The Village Square.
Good evening, everybody. On your table, this is definitely sing-alongable, please. There are lyrics, and I hope you'll join in if you know the tune. This is, just to kind of set the stage a little bit, this is a song for Lucy Morgan, sung by, you have to imagine me in a black robe and being a man and being kind of unhappy. You ready? Okay. What can I sing? What's there to say? Oh, Lucy Morgan, you took my chord away. The Taj Mahal, it was as nice as it could be. It got blown up by a mean witch whose name Lucy. I thought that she was just a Times retiree. Oh, she's someone that I'd like to dismember. There are no sunny skies, and it's because of you. I lost my private bathroom and granite counters too. Miles of African wood like at the Poynter Institute. Lucy's someone that I'd like to dismember. Jim Greer looks forward to you covering his trial. No mountain home for you this summer time. The GOP, they will be crying all the while. You'll block their dirty laundry with great style. It doesn't matter if we lie or spin to you. You'll read the email and you'll figure out what's true. I wish you would retire so I could come back and play. Oh, she's someone that I'd like to dismember.
Dismember, dismember, Lucy's someone that I'd like to dismember.
Thank you. You would not believe the number of songs they have. Lawrence is very prolific. And we're actually in a song, the Village Square is on a song called Happy Talk. We didn't want that sung tonight. I'd like to now introduce our moderator for the evening, Neil Skeen. Neil is perhaps best known around Florida for his column on State Government for Florida Trend, and as a St. Petersburg Times bureau chief in Tallahassee in the 1980s. Formerly editor and president of Congressional Quarterly, Neil is now vice chairman of Med Affinity Corporation, a Tallahassee-based company providing next-generation electronic health records technology to medical professionals. And he didn't even ask me if I could invest. Is it too late?
No.
It sounds pretty good. He is also a member of the board of directors of the Village Square. Neil.
I need my valet.
Okay, hold on.
We're switching. Oh, all right. Great. Well, I'll tell you, if you're concerned about violence in media, Roseanne, there's a lot of dismembering going on here tonight. But it's a full moon tonight. Explains a lot. And so I hope you're prepared for quite an evening. Tonight's program is Media Wars, the Future of How and What We Know. We're going to focus on the war between conservative and liberal media, on the war between the east and west sides of Tampa Bay, between print and digital, and maybe even between young and old. We've got really an extraordinary panel, and I want to confess early on that there's a lot of St. Pete Times roots here, and some of that is probably my own fault, but I wanted to help us get together a group of people that we would all just love to spend an hour or two with, and these were people I could vouch for, and besides, there's no St. Pete Times anymore anyway, so I thought it would be okay. For two of our guests, this has really been an incredible couple of weeks. John Harwood, after being the moderator for the presidential debate in which Rick Perry had the oops moment heard around the world, was parodied on Saturday Night Live, played by Fred Armisen, and was on Stephen Colbert's Best Available panel. If you haven't seen that, he basically, whoever the first three people who respond to his phone call are, show up to be on Colbert. John was teamed up, among others, with David Cassidy, the teenage pop idol, whose roots in politics go to his parody of Hunter S. Thompson, and I'm not making up this title, Come On, Get Happy, Fear and Loathing on the Partridge Family Bus. So John was the comic relief on that panel. Lucy Morgan was featured on National Public Radio in an interview with Noah Adams. Some of you probably heard that, those three of you who do listen to National Public Radio. And I personally was interviewed about politics by the guy next to me at the bar at Andrews. But I do want to, so first I want to, I want to say one other thing. Liz introduced Laird Anderson, Flo Ashby. I have known them for many years. I'm so glad they've endowed this lecture series at FSU. They've been great contributors since they were in school at FSU a few years ago. And I just like to, Laird was a great journalist. He was with the Wall Street Journal and then taught at American University for many years in journalism. I'd just like to say thank you once again to you guys. So joining me, we're going to do sort of, if you're old enough, it's sort of like Johnny Carson, where we sort of have like the spotlight guests for a while, and then we just keep adding to the panel until finally they just move off the stage entirely. Sort of the Ed McMahon of the evening is Lucy Morgan. I would like to think of her more as the Kathy Lee Gifford. But Lucy, come on out, Lucy. You get the... You get the left wing down there.
But I'm so right wing.
You're just always right. Lucy and I together are going to interrogate our panel this evening. Everybody knows Lucy's story, but I can't help just telling a couple of things. She was the bureau chief in the St. Pete Times Bureau for 20 something years, about 20. I lasted only 4 in that job, so you can see how good she is.
How old I am now.
And I came before you.
True.
Her 1973 jail sentence was probably well-deserved, but was overturned by the Florida Supreme Court in what was really a landmark ruling for the reporter's ability to protect confidential sources. She won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing the corruption of, it's funny about this, the same sheriff whose jail she was in.
Now, wait just a minute. It was the prior sheriff I would have had to serve under, and he told me the best cell he had was mine.
Oh, okay. That was good. It always helps to have influence. She was named by Governor Jeb Bush to the Women's Hall of Fame. I got that right, right?
You did.
Okay. She always told me I asked dumb editor questions, so anything I could say to get back at this. One of my favorite lines about Lucy comes from Allison DeFore, our own Village Square board member, who says he met Lucy at a... Allison, it's hard to believe, given his attire, but he was once the sheriff of Monroe County, or maybe it's not so hard to believe. And he says he met Lucy at a Florida Sheriff's Association meeting shortly after she won that Pulitzer for getting the sheriff, and he said the sheriffs flowed around her sort of like a school of fish around a shark. So anyway, welcome our co-host for the evening, Lucy Morgan.
Thank you, Neil. Once told me that if I ever wanted to give up the bureau chief's job, it was the best job he ever had, and he wanted to come back, and I agree. It is a great job. But we're here to talk a little bit about journalism, and I am, unlike some of my fellow journalists, fairly optimistic about journalism. I know we have seen the decline of some papers, some closer to us than others, but not a lot has changed. When I became a reporter in 1965, they handed me a camera I didn't know how to operate and told me I had to take all my own pictures. We're back to doing that these days. We're all taking pictures. We're shooting videos. We're blogging. We're tweeting. Facebooking. We're doing all of these kinds of things to communicate. And almost all of us have lost staff. I think we're going to go through, hopefully not too much longer, a period where you do see reduced staff, that we will shake out in the end, still delivering information. The method we deliver it is going to be different. I don't think any of us envisioned, certainly not 20 years ago, that we would be delivering things online or on a telephone or an iPad or all the other ways that you get your news. But I think we're going to see more of that. Probably things we haven't dreamed will exist will be the ways you get your news in another 20 years. We've lost a lot of journalists. Some of them are now in state offices as public information officers and in other places. Some of them probably should have gone there earlier and didn't. But I my greatest fear is that we're going to lose a lot of young reporters who feel threatened and really fearful about the industry and leave us too soon. Because I think on the other end of what's happening to journalism, we're going to still be delivering information to people and ferreting out wrongdoing among judges and anybody else that gets in our way, and that things will come out of this other end.
Well, we have a lot of people to help us talk about some of those things and what's going on in the future of media. I think that one of the things is that in the future, as an economic move, rather than having reporters covering all of the state agencies, that the now Tampa Bay Times is simply going to project a hologram of Lucy into every state agency.
A scarecrow?
Scarecrow. Yeah, that would be it. So, well, one of the, in putting together this panel, I thought it was about time that John Harwood came back to Tallahassee. And, right. There have been some changes since John left here in, I guess it was end of 84 would have been when you left, to go cover the Reagan campaign from Washington for the St. Pete Times, what was the name of that paper? The St. Pete Times. Things have changed, John noticed when he came back to Tallahassee. The airport is now much larger. the planes, however, are much smaller. And there are not any more of them. John and I were in the St. Pete Times Bureau for about a year, a little over a year together during the Graham administration. You remember Mary Childs is here. You remember the Bob Graham administration. John grew up in Bethesda, just outside of Washington. He was the son of a Washington Post reporter, political reporter, and ultimately deputy managing editor of the Post, Dick Harwood. He went to Duke, to college, and then came to the St. Petersburg Times as a, he came as a summer intern, I think, in 1978. I think I got that right, or 77. 77, there you go. So he went to the Washington Bureau for the Times in 1991. He became the White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, a great job. Then became the political editor and the chief Washington, the chief political correspondent. Eventually, back then, CNBC and the Washington, Wall Street Journal were friends. And John started appearing on CNBC. He then moved full time to CNBC and sort of shifted to writing more for the New York Times. John has a quite a schedule. He's going to be live on Squawk Box tomorrow at 6:10 a.m. From a studio here in town. We will be calling you with our roto dial at 6 to be sure you're up to listen. And his day can also end with Larry Kudlow at 7 o'clock. And so, he's a great journalist, he's a great friend, and so, straight from the set of the Colbert Report, let's welcome back to Tallahassee, John Harwood.
Oh, no. You may think that Neil has gone crazy, but back in the day when Neil and Harwood worked together in the Bureau, they were both single and much loved by all of these single women in the Capitol. I think they kept men's cologne in their desk drawers so that they could...
Didn't need it. They had to fly them off. Most of them came to see John. So who's better at this?
Is this on?
It's on. It's on. This is live.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for an email. My day might end tonight on the last word with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC at 10:15. They're waiting to see if they can line up the studio.
We'll get you out of here
so
in time.
If you don't want to get up at 6:15, you could catch it before you go to bed, although it's not must-see TV, I will say that.
Must see NBC, and that what MSNBC
yeah,
says.
Exactly. Yeah, so.
John, since you're going to be on tonight, can I ask you, what do you think of today I am most aggravated when I turn on one of these television talk shows by the hosts who are screaming at their guests and interrupting them and not allowing them to answer questions and taking a position instead of pretending to be a journalist. What do you think of those people?
I think they are trying to make a living. One of the realities of our business, so the news and information business is under pressure in many ways, right? Newspapers trying to survive. Neil's trying to preserve the space and the penetration for the St. Pete Times, now Tampa Bay Times, changing the name is part of that. Television networks, cable TV also has to try to figure out a way to keep a foothold in a marketplace where broadcast TV is declining, cable's rising, but opinion cable is really rising, and opinion internet is threatens to submerge all of it, all of the television stuff. So Fox built a very successful business model, self-consciously styling itself as the conservative alternative to liberal mainstream media, and what has happened in response to Fox, which is so dominant, they're not just kicking our butt, they're kicking our butt big time. It's sort of like the way Florida State kicked the butt of Carolina in basketball a few weeks ago. That's how bad Fox is beating the rest of cable.
And Duke?
That was a more narrow and kind of an aberrational kind of game.
Would it be that you went to Duke, John?
Yes, I did. That was put that in the category of freak events. So you have CNN, which has always been a straight down the middle news organization, totally disoriented by the threat and the declining market share that it has. MSNBC, part of the network that I work for, has responded to that by trying to, in essence, be Fox on the left. And so Al Sharpton has a show, Ed Schultz has a show, Rachel Maddow has a show, Lawrence O'Donnell, the show that I might do tonight, he's a guy I used to cover. He was the staff director for the Senate Finance Committee when I was covering the Hill. This is how this industry is trying to survive. People like me who don't do opinion journalism have to kind of fight for our continuing role in this process. The more people who are willing to watch something that's more muted, less opinionated, less shouty, the better off we are. But so far, that model has not proven to be as robust as the others.
That's sad.
Really the highlights, I think, of your career was when, in an interview with you, President Obama uttered the words, "I got the sucker." Mm-hmm. And I believe he wasn't talking about Osama bin Laden.
We have had I've had a couple of interesting moments with Obama in interviews. You're talking about, I thought you were just about to say, the moment when we were preparing for an interview, we were getting made up, I'd actually brought my daughter to the interview and was engaging in small talk with Obama, and he was asking my daughter where she wanted to go to college and all that. And it happened to be the night after Kanye West had snatched the microphone from Taylor Swift at the Country Music Awards. Does anybody remember that? And I said, "So, Mr. President, were your daughters as hacked off as mine were about what happened to Taylor Swift?" And he turns to my daughter, trying to relate to her, and said, "He was a jackass." And this was something that was not part of the interview. It was off the record. Because when you're just chit-chatting, that's not considered, you know, when getting made up and mic'd up and all that, it's not really considered part of it. However, that video feed went out to every television network, and so a colleague, a friend of mine from ABC, Terry Moran, was watching that at his desk, didn't realize what it was, he just heard it, and so he tweeted, "Obama calls Kanye West a jackass." And that became a brief sensation. We wouldn't put it on TV, but other people eventually did because the video was out there. But you're talking about something different.
Yes. The sucker he got was not Osama bin Laden.
But a fly. You may remember when this was an interview in June of 2009. I believe that I was interviewing the president about his forthcoming Wall Street regulation bill. And we were, when you do an interview with the president, there's a whole lot of people involved. We had a fancy rig where the cameraman could glide down these rails and change the angle of the shot constantly, and you had sound people and lighting people and all that. And while we were there in the East Room, some people noticed that there was a rather large fly buzzing around the room, a singular fly. And a producer was assigned to take her legal pad and chase this fly out of the room. So she tried to chase it out of the room and actually did, and got the fly through these double doors to the room next to the East Room, shut the double doors. Right after that happened, White House staffer came over and said, we want those doors open because we want depth to the president's shot, and if we have the doors open, the camera will shoot not just him but the room behind him. It will look classier. So he said, okay, and we just decided, kind of forgot about the fly. And while the interview started, the fly's kind of like over here, and it's sort of moving closer, and, you know, Mr. President, what are you going to do about too big to fail? Like, and the thing was right, like, circling in front of his nose, and he finally just started laughing and said, hold on a second, and he put his hand out. It was an awesome performance, actually. He put his hand out. The fly just perched on his hand, and he... One swat, he gets a fly and he flicks it on the floor and he does this kind of macho thing. He says, now, where were we? And the cameraman is interested. He says, you want to see it? I got the sucker. And he points to it just like that. That video, for a brief period, became, for like 24 hours, was the most watched piece of video in the world on YouTube. And, you know, that Lucy, you know, wins a Pulitzer Prize. I was present for the fly. And
he was practicing for Osama.
Exactly.
And as I recall, it was a very hardwood line after, and you just said, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually they made that. Somebody made a rap video out of it. It was like a rap remix. It was awesome. You can see it. It's on the internet.
So this is almost like when you liked Michael Jackson. I mean, it was like really
Rick James or something.
I
was injected into pop culture in this way.
That's right.
It doesn't take much to entertain.
The one other thing I want to talk about, and then actually we might do something serious, but I really would, I think it's interesting to talk in kind of a slow motion description of the unraveling of Rick Perry.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are. You're the moderator, along with Maria Bartiromo from CNBC, the financial anchor, who isn't really a political expert. She's there because she's the most beautiful person at CNBC, and also because she's the anchor of the big After the Bell show.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually, by the way, I thought a terrific moment in interviewing. But why don't you describe what happened?
What happened? I know all these debates run together, and they certainly do for me. But you know, the candidates complain, by the way, there are too many debates, and they say that, you know, news organizations are doing it for their own benefit, and they're, you know, putting us through hell and messing with our schedules. There's some truth to that. Newspapers and television networks love to promote themselves through events like this. So that's life. So we have our CNBC debate. There had been a series of ones coming up in the fall. You are somewhat at the mercy, when you have these debates, of the mood that the candidates walk into the room with. Sometimes they have a real motive to mix it up and fight and argue, which is what tends to make the most interesting electric moments. And other times, they're just in, like, stand pat, play it safe mode. As it happened, there was a debate the previous week, or maybe 2 weeks earlier, when the Republicans had viciously gone after Romney. Rick Perry had really gone after him, Gingrich a little bit. And there was a reaction within the party that they were too negative. And so they had a motive. They walked into this debate with the motive of smoothing it over. So I start from the beginning with questions to Romney about, you know, the issue of flip-flops, which is an allegation that's sort of followed him for a long time, and I invited Perry to tee off on that. And Perry at that time was still somebody that we thought might emerge as the ultimate challenger to Romney, and he just wouldn't bite. He wouldn't do it. And in fact, none of the candidates had any motive to mix it up with one another. They had just decided they weren't going to. Gingrich did a little smackdown of Maria. You know, Gingrich was like to play the media in the debates, his strategy. Romney, when you're in a family fight, which is what primaries are, campaigns are wary of offending people who are otherwise on their side, you know, the supporters of the fellow party members. So they look for other targets, and Romney's strategy has been to attack Obama, ignore the other Republicans, and Newt's has been to attack the media. And Maria asked a question. She asked the candidates to start talking about health care. She said, 30 seconds, give me your health care plan. And three of them give their answers, just perfectly normal and routine. And Newt Gingrich says, you've asked an absurd question. And so he, you know, and Maria, to her credit, sort of stood up and said, well, are you going to answer it? And he said, well, it was really absurd. She said, are you going to answer it? And then he finally backed down and answered the question. But that still was kind of weak tea. And halfway through the debate, we were all dying in our own heads because we didn't have any – I couldn't think of what the lead of the story was. There wasn't one. And then a gift from God in the form of Rick Perry arrived when Rick Perry – begins talking, and he's getting all Texas-like swaggery about it. He goes, let me tell you something. When I get in there, there's three agencies that are going to go, okay? Education, energy, or education, commerce, and, that's the third one. And he stops, and it was kind of like strange. Is he kidding? And there starts to be a little low rumble of laughter in the thing, and Ron Paul is trying to help him out and says, I'd cut five agencies. And it's getting a little uncomfortable now. And then Mitt Romney says, EPA? Is that the third one?
And in your ear.
Right. And so at that moment, when it's kind of chaos and laughter, one of the imperatives you have when you're moderating a thing like that is to keep it moving. Keep it interesting. So Maria decides to go to another question, and she begins to ask a question about the budget deficit. At that moment, a very smart producer in our truck, who realized that this candidate was drowning in front of our eyes and would like to give him a little longer opportunity to drown.
Throwing an anchor to a drowning man, right?
So exactly. He opens up the switch to my ear, because he can talk to any one of us, and says, don't stop with this, okay? So I cut Maria off, and I said, okay, hold on a second, Governor. Is EPA the – because Romney had said it, laughter, and Perry had said something like, yeah, EPA. I said, is that the one you're talking about? And in a way that was, like, mystifyingly generous to me, Perry says, no, actually, that wasn't the third one. I should have known that that was not the third one in his riff, but I didn't know. And
you didn't know what the answer was.
No, I hadn't. I did not.
Did you have an oops moment too?
What's that?
Were you having an oops moment too?
No. It's just that I had not absorbed the little riff in his speech where he talked about the third agency. So he said, I said, is EPA the third one? He said, no, sir, it wasn't. And I said, okay, can you name the third one? And then he really, like, doubled up and said, okay, it's education, commerce. And then he just kind of surrendered and he said, oops. And it became one of those moments that was an indescribable little moment that was entirely the result of him, the result of my smart producer, and a little rudimentary back and forth between me and him. So,
well, that was great.
And the best part about it from my standpoint, I mentioned this earlier at our talk. When I did the interview with Obama on the fly, my friend Maureen Dowd wrote a column in the New York Times about this incident, and the kicker was, and sad to say for John Harwood, no matter what else happens in his career, the first line of his obituary will always be, he was the one sitting there when Barack Obama killed the fly. So the Perry thing happens, that was bigger, and I wrote her a note and I said, can you rewrite my obituary now? I think Perry gets a little mention in there.
I think we could thank you for getting rid of Rick Perry.
Well, which raises one other thing, and I think I'll make this sort of our introduction to conservative, liberal mm-hmm. kind of media, and then we'll bring some others up here in the limited time we have remaining. But in a different debate shortly after that, Newt Gingrich really took off on John King from CNN for the question he asked, and I thought, and it became really sort of an issue, and a lot of people thought King was sort of off base with that question, and I thought I just, you know, in this world of highly politicized mm-hmm. Debate and media, what did you think of that?
I don't think he was off base at all with this question. I think you had to ask that question, especially in the context in which, first of all, character is an issue, people running for president. And you had a proximate news event, which was this interview that Marianne Gingrich was giving, which wasn't entirely different in terms of the nature of the information. But nevertheless, I think it was something that was worth asking about. I might not have asked it as the very first question, but I think the more challenging thing was the ferocity of Newt's response to it, which was beautifully played on his part. And it became an independent factor in the election to his benefit, to the South Carolina benefit. When I don't think it would be a moderator could be prepared for how strongly Gingrich came back, because that was a very remarkable thing. For John, I wish that he had had a different response to it. John is a great journalist and a friend. And very skilled on television, but when he responded to Gingrich by saying something to the effect of, well, it wasn't my network that put it on, and Gingrich said, wait a minute, don't hide behind the other network, that was a legitimate comeback on Gingrich's part, because John was injecting it into the debate, and I wonder how history might have played out differently had Gingrich says, John, it's despicable and appalling that you asked me that question. It would have been a somewhat risky thing for King to do, but I think he would have been well-founded if he said, well, hold on, Mr. Speaker. There are some people who evaluate presidential candidates and care about the character of the candidates who think that what your ex-wife said that you did was despicable. So would you like to defend that? I think that would have been a legitimate way to come back at that, and it didn't happen. And so John got some criticism for that, and Gingrich was off to the races in South Carolina.
Lucy, let's hear from some more panelists.
All right. Next, we are going to bring up Neil Brown, who's my boss. He's editor at the Tampa Bay Times, formerly known as the St. Petersburg Times. When you've spent 43 years saying St. Petersburg Times, it's hard to change, especially when you're old and crotchety. Neil is originally from Chicago, but we won't hold being a damn Yankee against him, since I also married a Chicagoan. He started as a reporter at the Miami Herald, spent about 8 years there. I think you even covered the Keys, didn't you? What a posh assignment down there with all the dope smokers in the Keys. Then he went to Congressional Quarterly, where he was managing editor, and then joined the St. Petersburg Times in 1993 as, were you world editor? Did we call it world editor? See what it
Love that title.
It's a great title. Then in 2001 became the editor, where he has presided now over the recent change in name to the Tampa Bay Times. And we're going to get him to tell us a little bit about the name change and what he's doing to sort of calm the troops and keep things going.
Open seating. Is this on? Can you hear me? It's important, anytime you're with Lucy, hug first. Skeen, you didn't tell me I'd be answering questions from Lucy Morgan.
You wouldn't have come.
On everybody's table is a copy of the Tampa Bay Times. Everybody got one? All right. I'm gonna stand here for a minute if that's all right, because, well, can you see me if I sit?
Yeah.
All right. No. See. Okay. Good. Glad somebody's honest there. On everybody's table is a copy of the Tampa Bay Times, which you can't get here in Tallahassee, unfortunately, in print anymore. So I had some set up.
Since 1974, I think. But
No. Just since a couple years ago. And I want to open and get to your question about the Tampa Bay Times by telling a little story. If you think that our decision to change the name was a really good idea, then you can thank me and some others. If you think changing the name to the St. Pete Times to Tampa Bay Times is a bad idea, I'm going to show you how you can blame Neil Skeen. Okay? So bear with me. Here's how the story works. So Lucy said that I started my career, which is true, at the Miami Herald in the Key West Bureau. Okay? Downhill ever since, I need to tell you, okay? But I covered the Keys, and like Lucy, we just had to write a lot of stories. We used to have to take our own pictures. In fact, there was a great source of mine, a little Elliot Ness kind of guy named Allison DeFore, who would call every so often and sort of say, he was the assistant state attorney at the time, "I got a good one. Bring your camera." So I would run off and write a story about some drug bust that they were doing and take pictures. And in fact, I did a lot of those stories down in the Keys. And out of the blue one day, I get a call from an FDLE agent who says, "I've seen your work. It's pretty good work. I got to tell you about some corruption down in Key West." So I go meet this guy for coffee, and he says, "I need you to know I never talk to any reporters ever, except one." And he nods like I should know, and he says, "Lucy Morgan," right? To which I say, "Who's Lucy Morgan?" Didn't know anything. But anyways, he wound up cooperating quite a lot. We wrote a lot about corruption. Got some good 1A stories in the Miami Herald when it had a great Key West bureau. And I get promoted to go to Palm Beach County. I go, again, when the Herald had a Palm Beach office, and we can talk about what sort of happened to the business in general, but I go to the Palm Beach office, and they immediately send me to, I got to do two different sessions, cover the sessions up here in Tallahassee. And I came up to Tallahassee for the Miami Herald, and we had this great adjoining office with, it was Steve Doig and Mike Olive were the Herald folks. You must remember them. Some of you may. And right across the way were Neil Skeen and John Harwin. And, you know, it was this great, great, rich tradition of the Miami Herald, St. Pete Times, coverage of Tallahassee. And you can go back to people like Bob Shaw and others, and frankly, the great open records work laws that we have in the state and sunshine laws we have. We can thank those two institutions for that kind of commitment. They really helped write those laws. And so I got to work with Neil and John. The cologne was everywhere. You're absolutely right. And I learned a lot working for them and working right beside them. And it was sort of a really respectful competition, but there was a competition. You could tell that the adjoining door would suddenly close when somebody had a scoop. And off they would go, or off Doig and Olive would go. And I did two sessions that way, and I learned a ton. And so then I moved back down to Miami and covered politics in Miami. And shortly thereafter, John left to go to Washington, and Neil left to become the editor of the St. Pete Times Evening Institution, then the Evening Independent. Right? That was in 85, 86, something like that. He was the 84. And so under Neil was the very young executive editor of the Evening Independent. Well, Neil, on your watch, they closed the paper.
I noticed that.
Right?
They closed.
November 1986, they closed the newspaper. Sad day. PM paper couldn't exist. And Gene Patterson, just 30-some days later, the very next month, announced that with the money and the resources saved by closing the Evening Independent, the St. Pete Times was going to expand fully into Hillsborough County and go after the Tampa Tribune. So, thanks to Neil, we moved into Tampa and Hillsborough County. And, of course, Neil went off to run Congressional Quarterly, and he did a great job. And that's where I actually met him. Well, met him again, because I knew him from before, and he hired me to CQ. But it's funny how all that sort of stuff sort of kind of comes full circle, because at the time, the Times ventured into Tampa with a vengeance, and we had a circulation of some 20,000 in Tampa. And thought, well, the great, truly great work of John Harwood, Neil Skeen, and Lucy Morgan, who then went on to be the leader in Tallahassee and others, would carry the day in Tampa. Well, candidly, it was harder than we thought. We had a formidable opponent in the Tampa Tribune, and for the longest time, there was still only a circulation of 20,000-25,000 for the St. Pete Times in Tampa. But then the world started to change, and thanks to the unique and independent ownership of the St. Petersburg Times, we stuck with it. We stuck with it with a sizable bureau here in Tallahassee, with a sense that newspapers matter, and I thank you all for being here because I know you're here because you're still believers in newspapers. And at a time when a lot of other organizations might have folded and said, well, this is, you can't do it on 20,000, we sort of stuck with it, in part because at the St. Pete Times we felt that there still was a need for not only a great newspaper in St. Petersburg, but a newspaper for the Tampa Bay region, and frankly, a statewide paper, which I'm sorry to report, there's not as many anymore. We may be the only one left. So over time, we stuck with it, and it actually brought us to the point of this past fall when we ultimately changed the name of the paper, and I want to explain a little bit about that. So it was 20,000 for a long time, and this wasn't going as well. All the Pulitzers, all the great work wasn't enough to win over the audience in Hillsborough County. But we did have two different visions versus our competitors. We did see regionalism as a good thing, that there is a strong metropolitan area to be had in the Tampa Bay market. And so, again, we stuck with it. We had a bureau in Tampa as big as any in the state. We have more reporters than everybody. And in the last 6 to 7 years, something tipped over. Between our good journalism, our stick-to-itiveness, some smarts on the business side, and the biggest criticism we heard over the years was we didn't have enough ads in that Tampa edition, as you guys may remember. But we made real gains. And while we have been extremely warmly received, obviously here in Tallahassee with Lucy and Steve Bosquet and others representing us, and many great journalists have come through this office, up here you appreciated the St. Petersburg Times to some degree a little bit more than some folks in Hillsborough County. So we did great muckraking, groundbreaking journalism, investigative journalism throughout, local journalism, but we weren't entirely getting the credit. And one reason why is that you all sort of feel it, whether it's the Democrat or your hometown paper. People feel a real connection to their local paper, and the name matters, as we found out. The journalism matters first and foremost, but the name matters too. So as we continued to grow, and as I said, about 6 or 7 years ago, things really started to turn. We made some great gains. We put a great commitment of resource into the journalism. And come this fall, we had reached the point where 75% of the readers of the St. Petersburg Times lived outside St. Petersburg. What's more, on Sunday, our circulation of our Sunday edition in Hillsborough County alone was 120,000. Now, that was telling us something that we needed to take a further step. As you may know, and I'm proud to tell you, the St. Pete Times for a long time has been the largest paper in the state of Florida. Our Sunday circulation is about 414,000. Orlando is second to us at 280,000 on Sunday. What's more, and this is somewhat of a sad commentary on the state of newspapers in general, the St. Petersburg Times in November, when we were still the St. Petersburg Times, at 414, had become the 11th largest paper in America, bigger than the Boston Globe, bigger than the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Dallas Morning News. So our work had been recognized. We won two Pulitzers in 2009. We pushed hard, and yet we still were not receiving full credit from a business standpoint in the region that we all call home. Interestingly, when Gene Patterson, who was the chairman of the company that pushed us into Hillsborough County in 1987, after closing your paper, there's a quote from the story where he announced we're moving into Hillsborough. Gene might have been premature, prescient, visionary, just like Nelson Pointer. He said, we want to be the paper for Florida's biggest city, the city of Tampa Bay. Now, that's hard to come by. We all have our identity, and we're always trying to juggle our local identity with our regional and state identity. And I think it's okay to have several, frankly. We don't ask anybody to not say they're from Tampa or to not say they're from St. Petersburg. You're from Tampa Bay. We can be part of both. But we felt it was time to go ahead and make the move to reflect not only the region, how the region saw itself. All the sports teams call themselves Tampa Bay. As I said, 75% of our market was outside of St. Petersburg. But also what our aspiration is. And we actually think that as an agenda setter that a newspaper and news organization should be, we needed to see things in a broader sense. So come November 1st, we announced that we were going to become the Tampa Bay Times. We understood. We did a lot of market research. I was telling Ron Sachs a moment ago, you know, you don't mess with a great brand. Or let's put it this way. You mess with a great brand at your own peril. But we had felt that we could stand by great journalism, great advertising content, that, frankly, if it's no good, it doesn't matter what you call it. And if it's really good, it doesn't matter what you call it. And so on the 1st of January, the St. Petersburg Times, with a little bit of melancholy in all our hearts, but with great sense of promise, became the Tampa Bay Times. You have copies on your desk. It's only 5 weeks into it, so I got an early report. So far, so good. In St. Petersburg, where we expected the biggest backlash, if you will, we've got actually a lot of support. A lot of pride, frankly, in the St. Petersburg Times in St. Pete. There's a lot of people who say, gee, I wish you hadn't done that. Maybe some of you are feeling the same way. But I get it, that if you want to serve a wider market, you need a name that reflects that market. In Hillsborough County, it's only one small measure. But in the 6 weeks leading up to the name change, our net gain in circulation had been about 300 copies. In the 5 weeks since, we've gained 3,200 copies. Does a name make that much difference? I don't know. But so far, that's all we've really done is change the name. We're going to continue to market it and things like that. So things are off to a very strong start. We are a company that still believes in newspapers. We believe in our website. We believe that we've got some great ideas for and how to basically reach audiences in all kind of ways, online and in print. We're constantly thinking up new things. Like all of you, we could stand for this economy to do a little better. To get the income that that we think we can get, but the name change we think is a vision for our region and a vision for Florida and a vision for journalism, and it's gone really well. So thank you, Neil. Now I'll sit down.
The flight of the Phoenix, that's really all it is. So.
At the risk of my job here, let me ask Neil another question. It seems to me that one
really
of
really let him have it.
Well, it seems to me that all of us are collaborating a little more than we used to. The Times and the Herald operate a single bureau here. At the moment, we have 10 people in the combined Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald bureau. Is this one of the paths that you see the newspaper industry taking for the future?
I do, actually, which is it's kind of like quality over quantity when you think about it. Okay, so when John and Neil were in one room and Olive and Dorig and me and some other folks were in another room, we all did great work, but we also often all showed up to cover the same event. Okay? Now, let's face it, the business model is different. It's hard. A lot of newspapers, well, you know it here, there's a lot smaller press corps here than there ever was. So we decided there are power in numbers. And while, listen, had the Miami Herald been across the bay, we would never have done it. But a lot of us are ex-Herald folks. It was compatible values. We said, why don't we go all in and form a true, what I like to think of as a journalistic powerhouse by taking two of the great news organizations in the state and combining resources. So we have Steve Bosquet covering one thing in Maryland Classic covering something else, and we are expanding coverage in Tallahassee in a different economic time. Yes. Is there a loss of competition? To some degree, yes. But I have to tell you, straight up, I've come to see that some of that competition was ego-driven and didn't have service to the readers or accountability to democracy behind it. Because, you know, what's the difference if somebody has something in the 20th graph of a story that somebody may or may not read? If we have two different stories, that's more and better coverage. And so you can't do it with everything. I couldn't obviously do it with the Tampa Tribune. We do believe in competition. But I think it's an extremely... not just cost-effective, because ultimately we didn't save any money. We just got a lot more money for what we were spending. And so we're very proud of this partnership, and we think it's really the way to go. You got to pick your shots, including you got to pick your partner as well. It's got to be compatible. And fortunately, the news values of the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald remain very strong.
Could I just have one postscript to that and make the observation that that sort of collaboration is a growing fact of life throughout the news business. One small example, I didn't even know about this until recently because I don't deal that much with the local NBC station that, although they're housed in the same building where the NBC Bureau is, where I do a lot of television, the ABC, NBC, and CBS affiliates in Washington, D.C. now pool video coverage of most scheduled news events in Washington. That is, where it used to be, everybody showed up with a crew and a correspondent. Now, in the same way that news organizations have pool coverage of White House events of the president, and that's for practical reasons because, there's financial savings involved, but also you couldn't practically have all these news organizations cover the same event. There are too many of them. But even where the mayor of Washington, D.C. has a press conference, there's now one pool camera for all those news organizations. They compete on the stuff that they think is the highest added value journalism, whether it's the investigative stuff they do or the more local TV-oriented things like the great car chase or the spectacular piece of local video from a breaking news event. They may will send their own cameras to that. But on the routine, like political, governmental stuff, it's now pooled in the same way.
I want to add to the conversation at this point somebody who's not a journalist is extracting profitability and growth from the work of the journalists.
Wait, you mean he's like sucking our lifeblood?
He's sucking your lifeblood.
Dang.
And he's going to come up and defend himself for this. Justin Safey was a speechwriter, I think the first speechwriter for Jeb Bush as governor, then was the communications director, meaning that he was on the other side of the issues from Lucy and these guys. He is now the founding shareholder and attorney in his own government consulting firm, the Safey Law Firm. He was appointed by President Bush, President George Bush, to the Council on White House Fellows in 2007. When he left here in 2002, he began publishing something called the Safey Review. Many of you may still see the Safey Review, and it collects the headlines and points you to the stories from newspapers and blogs and television from all over the state. And by the way, I also wanted to say, since we're going to talk about conservative and liberal media, Justin is also a frequent guest on Fox News. So I'd like for him to come up and join this group, Justin Safey.
Maybe Justin could tell us where the story would play if Jeb Bush were indicted tomorrow. Where would we see that on Safey Review in the morning?
You'd see it right there with all the other articles.
At the bottom, maybe?
Probably.
Wouldn't it depend on what the crime was?
No, it wouldn't. It doesn't matter.
Well, Justin, you've heard all of this, I wonder if you might think a little bit about your own strategy, your own approach to media, and where is all this going from where you've been and where you're headed?
Well, it's interesting because I started this site on August 16th, 2002, which is remarkable that it's going to be 10 years this August. And there was no YouTube, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter, none of these things that have become so dominant on the internet today didn't exist back then. And for me, the model that I looked at was a site called the Drudge Report. And the Drudge Report to me was remarkable because it was one page, not a lot of original content, but an incredibly useful resource because the editors were pulling content from all over the internet. And what occurred to me was that in Florida, we have such a wonderfully diverse state, so many interesting political stories, that there was no single page that someone could go to that was interested in state politics and get all of it. I also was frustrated because when I went back to Miami after working here in Tallahassee, it was very difficult for me to surf the different newspapers' websites and to dig into the different pages and to find the content that I was looking for, which was I wanted information about Governor Bush's reelection campaign that year. Bill McBride and Janet Reno were seeking the Democratic nomination, and I had formerly worked for the governor, and I was curious to see how his reelection campaign was going, and there was no resource like that. So I created it, and I provide that context because, you know, 10 years in the online business is, you know, 10 eternities. And now the way that things are going is that my model of having a human editor, I still think, is a very valuable model because we are drowning in more information than ever before. And or at least I know I am, and I can't read everything I want to read. So the value of having someone that's a trusted source to aggregate links, I think, is a value. And because even Google, with all the brilliant engineers that work at Google and the smart people that work in Mountain View, they still can't produce with their algorithms, as brilliant as they are. If you go to the Google search engine and type in Florida political news, you will still not get a results page. Even if you go to Google News and do that, you will still not get a results page that delivers the value that we deliver on our page because of the human editorial function that we provide, where we put the most salient stories at the top and the less important stories at the bottom.
Particularly if something bad has happened to a Republican.
Of course.
Okay.
You would expect no less. Actually, Lucy and I are joking. The site is, I am a registered Republican. I voted for John McCain in the last election. I voted for Rick Scott.
Voted for Rick Scott?
I voted for Rick Scott for governor. But, you know, my politics are well known, but the site itself is nonpartisan. Okay, all we do is pull links. There's no original content. I don't write a blog. I don't put any of my own viewpoints onto the site. It is meant to be a nonpartisan site where people who are interested in Florida politics can go. One advantage that I had at the time is that I knew that at that time there wasn't this spirit of collaboration that existed between the newspapers. They were still very much into super hyper-competitive mode. And so I knew that no newspaper would ever link to a story that appeared on another newspaper's website. They would never do it. It wouldn't even cross their mind. So I knew that there was a little niche there of someone that was willing to be agnostic about it and to basically say, you know what, I don't care where it comes from. My only criteria was that it come from a major Florida daily, and that's when I put it up on the site. So now I find it remarkable. Okay, you ask me where this is going. Where it's going is that newspapers now are aggregating content themselves. The New York Times does it. The St. Pete Times posts links to other newspapers on their site. The Orlando Sentinel does it. The Palm Beach Post does it as well. So it's really interesting. I think the future is going to be more along the lines of producing original content. It's going to be sharing content and being a resource to pointing people to where good content exists elsewhere on the internet, that there's too much information out there for anyone to think that they're going to be able to be the single source of information for what people are looking for in the news today. I think both of those functions are important. I also think that People are going to rely more, and they are already doing it, on their social networks to get information. They're going to rely on their friends on Facebook, their friends on Twitter. Twitter and Facebook are the biggest aggregators on the internet. Okay, they send more traffic to websites than they did for sure 5 years from now, and 5 years ago, and 5 years from now they'll do even more. The other thing that I think the future is also on mobile devices, and I think that's a market that we're exploring into. We're getting close to about 5,000 downloaded iPhone apps for our app. We have a safety review app that puts our content on iPhones. And so we want to dominate that mobile space for people that are interested in Florida politics, because as we get further along, more and more people are going to be consuming information from their mobile devices. And the final point I make about where we're going is we're going to niche publications. My publication is a niche publication. It's only about Florida politics. And if you ever read the article or read the book by Chris Anderson called The Long Tail, basically The Long Tail is the story of how niche publications, niche industries, or niche businesses, content businesses, can actually become profitable and work on their own, and they don't have to be blockbuster 300,000 circulation to actually become profitable, because distribution of information on the internet, is the cost of it is practically nothing. When I started my website, my monthly web fee for hosting my site was $19.95 a month. And I could get people across the world. I've gotten emails from people in China and India and Iraq who read the site for $19.99 a month, okay? I didn't have to pay for the newspaper carriers to get up early in the morning and pick up the papers and deliver them personally at people's home. That would be that's a barrier to entry. So on the internet, there's no barrier to entry. The cost of your distribution is practically nothing. So because of that, it allows someone like me to develop a site that has enough of a following. In the last 2 years, we've had 10 million page views on our site in the last 2 years.
Perhaps you should be paying a fee to the newspapers whose stories you're putting up there.
Somehow I had a feeling that someone would suggest that. And what I would say is that our site is the biggest, our site, of those 10 million page views that we've gotten in the last 2 years, we've driven 5 million visitors to Florida's newspapers. We've sent 5 million visitors to Florida's newspapers in the last, and who made money off of those visitors that I sent? The St. Pete Times did, the Miami Herald did, the Orlando Sentinel did, because they monetized the revenue from the visitors that I drove them based on the ad impressions that I gave them. And I'm not even charging a referral fee to send them all those to send them all those visitors. And I'm a lawyer, and so I know something about referral fees. And if you're in other businesses, typically when someone sends you a customer, a paying customer, not typically, but it's not unusual for that to happen. So from my perspective, I know that the Orlando Sentinel told me that we're averaging sending the Orlando Sentinel about 400,000 page views per month. The last time I checked with the Miami Herald, we are the number one referrer of traffic to the Miami Herald Naked Politics blog. The Tampa Tribune has told me that I'm in the top 10 websites that refer traffic to the Tampa Tribune website. So our site is in the top 10 referrers to the Tampa Tribune. So I look at it from the perspective of I am providing free marketing to the newspapers and driving paying customers to view their ads, which they monetize.
Neil, are you super grateful?
Here's the thing, and we all are struggling with this. The amount of money we make off the advertising from the referrals from the safety review wouldn't be enough to pay the referral fee, because the advertising dollars online are still so small when you get
but
right
just,
down to
it. I want to say one thing, because I do want Joe to come up too, but just say one something about the sort of what publishers called the switch from print dollars to internet nickels.
Yeah. Well, it's just a straight rate issue, okay? Because, and by the way, I want to say I agree with everything Justin said, and we're actually, I do think, listen, in addition to, obviously, we got to find ways to pay for the content we're generating. First of all, we're generating content. Justin's aggregating it, and to a great degree, it does expand the reach of the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald and everybody else. We actually want everybody to see our journalism as much as we can. unfortunately, to the question you have, is that because we don't know who those people are, because there's not very much registration, there's not the same, for a print newspaper, you sign up and you ask them to bring it to your house and you tell them who you are. We don't have that issue on the website. As a result, it's literally 5 to 10 cents on the dollar in terms of the advertising rates that we can get for online traffic. I'm not looking at a gift horse in a mouth. We're trying to diversify, find all kind of ways. I think ultimately we all have to get past the notion that there's a choice. It's either print or online. Everybody is living in this world with an excellent mix of print and online, depending on your lifestyle, depending on the day of the week, depending on who's in your household. Actually, the Tampa Bay Times started a publication 5 years ago called TBT. It is a print tabloid geared to young readers. And it is our fastest growing product with the most traffic and higher ad revenues than we get online. So I think we have to get past this sort of pitting each other against each other. We want the reach. The web has been an exciting part of our model. We do get a lot of referrals from Justin's site, and that's frankly good for democracy. So I think there's lots of right answers.
If I could just make one point on that, too. I, like you said at the beginning, I'm not a journalist. I've never been in the news business. I think the challenge for the papers is, from my outside perspective, is that in terms of the difference between advertising dollars now and on the Internet, the advertising dollars when you're a newspaper, there's a somewhat of a monopolistic price that they can charge advertisers. Because if you want a 300,000 or 400,000 person reach in the Tampa Bay area, there's really only one place you can go to get that. Okay, there's only one place you can go, and so they're able to charge a very high price, a premium, I would say. On the Internet, complete competition, free and open competition, so the advertising rates are much more competitive on the Internet than they are. And so, you know, the model that the newspapers had was built on, I would say, monopolistic, you know, ad pricing, because that's the way that they were the only distribution if you wanted to get there. That's the challenge that I see that the papers have to deal with in terms of how do they monetize their content generation in a free competitive marketplace.
Okay, Lucy, we need some fresh blood up here. Why don't you?
And speaking of fresh blood, he's going to bring it to us. We want to go next to the guy who is training the minds and hearts of the young journalists who are going to come our way and replace all of us when we go to that newsroom in the sky. Joe Ritchie is the night chair in journalism at FAMU. He previously was national and foreign editor at the Washington Post and the Detroit Free Press, and he's going to tell us a bit about what he's doing to prepare all these young students to jump into journalism.
Thanks, Lucy. I'm not used to being a cleanup hitter. I'm usually have a...
You have to hit it out of the park.
You're probably the only one here who could hit a home run. So it's... Well, and I heard you play, is it hockey?
I have played hockey, but it's been a while. Yeah, I'm sitting next to someone whose son actually used to be in goal some of the times when we played, but that's not.
I do have good sources.
Was more of a soccer player, but you know, it's the legs don't do what they used to do anymore. Yeah, it's a tough job trying to train young journalists in this day and age because. For one thing, and Justin's talking about how things are going to look in 5 years, things have changed already. Just in the last 5 years, and what we're trying to do is stay ahead of the curve, and it's one heck of a steep, sharp curve. Things are changing so fast that we don't even know what journalism is going to look like in not 5 years, in 3 years. The blogosphere has exploded in the last decade, more so in the last 5 years, and I've been trying to get my head around this, working with students who are technologically ahead of me already, who tweet and Facebook. I guess thanks to Louise, my wife there, who forced me a couple of years ago to finally cave in and get my own Facebook account when I was overseas. This is how we can keep track of our son. His son doesn't want to have his parents. But my students, I've just seen one walk in who's actually a full-time reporter at the Tallahassee Democrat. we do have good, bright young people who are able to get jobs, who understand this business as well as I can pretend to already. It's just an amazing curve. In some ways, I see myself still as being a little bit of a troglodyte, though. I still want what Neil and John and what you folks have been doing and what I've been doing for a couple of decades. And John, you've got your dad's jaw. I worked with Dick Harwood in Washington, and he's a model. The folks who dig for information and do the service to democracy, which I think we lose sight of that sometimes with all the technological change, with all the blogging and tweeting, we forget that there is still an important role, and I work hard every day to try to keep that in front of our students to remember that there is a function that they still fulfill to the society that's extremely important. It's critical. That said, we're finding fewer and fewer folks who want to do it. But I want to talk about one young lady who, in a couple of weeks, we're getting ready to send to halfway around the world to China. A young lady who, after her freshman year, was on a reporting team that we assembled. We took six young people to South Africa to meet up with six Chinese journalism students, we were at the World Cup in South Africa for about 6.5 weeks, and Clarice Polk, and the reason I mention her is that she's the last editor-in-chief of the FAMU. She's getting ready to take a semester abroad in China. She's just a sponge, taking in all this stuff. She kind of wants to be a traditional newspaper reporter, foreign correspondent type, but she's learning how to blog, how to shoot and edit video, how to do audio podcasts, and is really a 21st century reporter, yet still was able to do some of the things that I would like to see journalists continue to do. When we were in South Africa, for instance, she wrote an extremely smart, in-depth analysis, a piece about the HIV/AIDS crisis in that country, with a couple of dozen original sources. The first trip out of the country, she talked to national government officials and provincial government officials, face-to-face interviews. We had a helpful person cart her around, Joburg, quite a bit, but it was refreshing to see that. She was under fire quite a bit in the past couple of months because of our hazing scandal, which everyone has heard about. Got a lot of criticism from her peers, folks that didn't understand. Well, why are you putting that stuff out there? What are all those mistakes you're making? They were doing extremely good coverage of that event, and it paid off. This is someone you all are going to be hearing, along with Jordan there. You're going to be hearing from Clarice Polk, from Jordan Culver. The future of journalism. I'm like Lucy, I am a little optimistic. There's some excellent people out there. But I'm also a little pessimistic because of the bigger picture of what I'm seeing. And nothing against public relations. We teach it well. And Ron, you do an excellent job. And I know you take a lot of our great kids as interns. But we're seeing far too many proportionately of our students going in that direction as opposed to a direction where they're providing information to the public for the benefit of democracy in our society.
I want to stop and see if we've got one or two audience questions you'd like to ask anybody on the panel. If you've got one, all right, we got the former publisher over here, Carol Dadisman.
PJ, can you get... We got to get him a mic, so hold on just one second.
Hang on, Carol. She's bringing the microphone to you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Neil Brown if the Tampa Bay Times has any plans to implement a paywall on your website, and in a larger sense, what effect do you think paywalls, when they are implemented, will have on the future of print newspapers?
The question was about paywalls, and it's something we talk about all the time. You know, based on my remarks earlier, you can tell, even as optimistic as we are still in one of the true, rare, competitive markets, and they are rare in this country right now. So we looked at a paywall model, much like the New York Times, more of a metered. You get so many for free, and then at some point a fee kicks in. But we decided that because of the competition and the fact that we have such a good reach right now, to go ahead and table the notion of a paywall, at least in the short term. You can get a lot of good information from Miami, Tampa, other places. We thought we don't want to limit ourselves right now. And the dollars, you know, obviously the newspaper industry has a problem. Once you started giving it away for free, it's really tough to start to charge. And so even with the affection and the admiration that people have for the Tampa Bay Times, formerly the St. Pete Times, we felt like the dollars that we would bring in from a paywall are still not as much as we hope to get with advertising. We've certainly expanded what we offer online as a way to get more advertising and also as a way to serve democracy. At some point, I'll talk a little bit about PolitiFact, which is a huge driver of traffic and a great journalistic product. Here's the reality about web traffic. Our two biggest slices of traffic come from, after the main Tampa Bay Times site, PolitiFact, which is a huge win, and our mugshot site, where we scrape the mugshots from the four county area off the sheriff's office. Again, sometimes PolitiFact and mugshots overlap, but there is just so much traffic there that we still think advertising is still the way to go. We haven't given up on internet advertising, even if it's smaller dollars. So it's always out there as an option. Our inclination at the moment is to still try to reach as many people as we can.
One of our there's actually a question here from the crowd that people wrote down. If you'd rather write a question, Liz will pick it up, just sort of wave it to her. But somebody asked that you talk a little more about PolitiFact and just say sort of where that come from, what's it doing for you and for the world.
We're extremely proud of PolitiFact. We have a PolitiFact National and PolitiFact Florida. We also have now, counting our PolitiFact Florida site, 10 partner states. We just began PolitiFact Tennessee with the newsrooms of the Knoxville and Memphis newspapers. PolitiFact is a great site. I'll tell you a little. We got a piece of fan mail the other day which sums up the strength of PolitiFact and goes to sort of what John was talking about earlier. The fan mail said, "Dear PolitiFact, I know the truth lies somewhere between Fox and MSNBC, and I'm just hoping you can help me figure out where it is." So we have some between our 10 partner states and the Tampa Bay Times. We have some 20 people dedicated to basically spending the time, and we do put accuracy over speed. So sometimes we don't do it right away. To analyze political speech and increasingly the speech of pundits. We have a little ongoing battle now with Rachel Maddow, for instance, but where I think a lot of the punditry is where a lot of people get their information to some degree more than the candidates themselves. And so it's all on the record sources. It's all original source material. As I like to say, we show our math, and then we put, I'll be honest with you, it's a gimmick. It's called the Truth-O-Meter, and we rate the speech from true, mostly true, half true, mostly false, and of course pants on fire for the most ridiculous stuff. And of course there's so much flying around the internet, chain emails, things like that, that it's an extraordinary consumer service. It's one of our most successful ventures. It's a piece of innovation. It goes back to this point for Joe and for Justin, which is it all still starts with the reporting, whether it winds up online, in print, on the air. You have to have strong, accurate reporting. And I'll make one last pitch about not just PolitiFact, but about the Tampa Bay Times in an increasingly complicated world. I think that there is a business model, not to mention a moral imperative on independence. And in this day and age, when we get information flying at us in so many ways, and you don't know where it's coming from, and people can manufacture their own truth, their own sort of persona, that if you can find a few institutions, of which we like to think the Tampa Bay Times would at least be one, not the only by any means, that you could at least think is independent and has some credibility, and then let the audience and the voters and the readers decide for themselves, then we think somehow the future will still be pretty bright.
Let me add one point. I think one of the big dangers that we see here, and it's happening all over the country, are these supposed news sites that are funded by God knows who are purporting to be legitimate news organizations, and yet some of them are spending quite a bit of money, and we don't know who's financing them. Is it an oil drilling company? Is it Koch Industries? We don't know. And I think that's a real something people need to look at.
I think disclosure is really critical. That doesn't mean once it's disclosed, it still can't be a credible site. Justin talks about his own political views, but that site absolutely seems to me to be an aggregated site of links from all over. It has no particular take, but it's good to know who you are and what you're about. And I think disclosure is, I think people can handle the truth. They just ought to know where things are coming from.
Okay, let's tell you what's going to happen here. We're going to take not a real break, but I want everybody to stand up, and it gives us a moment to reflect and see what we're really missing and sort of fine-tune that for your last half hour here. And we're going to do that in just a second. Before we break, Liz is going to introduce another musical interlude, perhaps with less violence this time. But I want to go into the break with one quick question that I want everybody to answer in no more than two sentences, and this is one from the audience. It says, who, if anyone, in your opinion, is the Walter Cronkite of journalism?
We're doing that now.
Yeah, you're going to do that right now. This is impromptu. John, you're the on-air guy. You have to think on your feet.
There is no Walter Cronkite today, and Walter Cronkite could not exist in this environment. But I will say, as a postscript to what Neil just said, I think PolitiFact is a spectacular innovation, a model of what journalism can be and should be. And I think the Truth of Meter is a lot less hokey and more realistic than the silly Pinocchio measure that the Washington Post and its rival fact-checking thing has instituted.
It's a nose for news. Neil, who's Walter Cronkite?
Well, I agree with John. I'm not sure Walter Cronkite can exist anymore. I'm a little bit more upbeat in general about some of the network TV guys. I think Brian Williams is pretty strong. Tim Russert was strong, although he sort of veered a little bit. That's two sentences. I gotta think about
that's
it, but I'd say Brian Williams, maybe.
Justin, it's not Bill O'Reilly, right?
So. No. Or Sean Hannity. There is no Walter Cronkite, and I say thank God. I really do. I believe that. I'm coming from the right, and so from my perspective, I am delighting in the fact that there are millions and millions of points of information that I can access on the internet, and that power is no longer concentrated in the hands of three or four people who get to decide what America's 300 million people get to watch on TV every night. I think that's a good thing.
Joe.
Wow. Well, I think I agree that there is no Walter Cronkite, but I kind of wish there were. Wow, Walter Cronkite. I'm stuck. I can't...
I think that answers the question, though, perhaps. Lucy, you got to nominate?
I think it's a combination. You're right. Walter's gone. But I think it's a combination of the nightly news anchors who still play to a huge audience, the three major networks, plus good independent newspapers who are daily putting out an incredible product with information crammed in it. If you read the Tampa Bay Times, the New York Times, some of the other national newspapers, preferably those that are not part of big chains, the chains have cut their own products so much they are barely recognizable. And if you live in this town, you know exactly what I'm talking about. There are still good newspapers that are the substitute for Walter.
Okay, now we're going to do the seventh inning stretch kind of break, okay? So if you leave the room, we're going to know it's because you really have to go. So don't leave the room or we'll know. Roseanne, you want to just bring this back up?
Sure.
And here we are, and then we'll take, just sort of stand for a minute, and then we'll start. So don't go anywhere.
Okay.
Here we go.
I was going to introduce this with some discussion, but I think I'm just going to kind of hit it. And if you want to sing along, whenever you're ready. Oh, Justin Safey. Oh, Justin Safey. Oh, Justin Safey, you once used to work for Jeb. Master of the World Wide Web, my Safey baby, you run the review from bed. I think you're out of sight. Show me how you want it to be. Tell me, Justin, cause I need to know now. Oh, because my readers all are leaving me. Safey reviews what they want to see. If I'm not on it, I lose my mind. Give me a sign. Aggregate me one more time. Oh, Justin Safey. Oh, Justin Safey.
All my stories.
What? Start.
A little interlude.
Thanks, darling. I know this song. I'm Justin Safey. I'm famous because of you. Posting all my stories. I bet you, baby, there's nothing that I would not do to be hyperlinked by you. Show me how you want it to be. Tell me, Justin, cause I need to know now, because my readers all are leaving me. Safey reviews what they want to see. If I'm not on it, I lose my mind. Give me a sign. Aggregate me one more time.
Okay, let me just throw this question out, because it's another one that's sort of a couple of sentences of answer, maybe. But somebody wanted to know from the panel, what steps will or can the media take to address the super PACs and the ads that will predictably attempt to message or drown out the facts of the upcoming election? What's the media role with respect to super PACs?
Well,
you're going to start?
I think we've got to find where the money's coming from, and it's a very difficult job. If you looked at the New York Times in the last few days, they have been trying to measure the money from the super PACs, and even they ran a little story asking for help from readers in identifying particular companies who have donated a lot of money. It is very difficult with all of these foundations and 501c3s and 527s to track money from one place to another, and it's going to take everything every news organization has got to be able to find it.
That's what I was going to say. You got to get to the bottom of who's funding these things, and it needs more transparency. It's really upsetting the political process.
And I would just add, in addition to that, I would say PolitiFactum. You know, I think that in addition to finding out who's funding it, if the message is true, the message is true. But if it's false, then they need to be held. The people who are promoting it need to be held accountable for that.
Yeah, two things I'd say. One, I obviously agree, PolitiFact will be a great source of that, because ultimately we still want to know if what they're saying is true or not true. But secondly, and this is, again, the exciting time we live in, the sort of crowdsourcing that Lucy's talking about is, let's put everybody on the case. Who are these guys? A lot of our audience may know who these folks are, and they should reach out to us, to the media, and at least give us tips on how to find out who these folks are. But ultimately, and that's number one, but I do think it matters, is what they're saying true or not true?
I agree with that. I will say that a lot of the sleuthing that is done to try to uncover where the money comes from, which is difficult because you have sort of shell company layered on top of shell company layered on top of shell company, which obscures it. But to the extent that those mysteries have been unraveled by some of my colleagues at the Times, it's usually you find that it's coming from the usual suspects. That is to say, it is not surprising that Mitt Romney's allies in the financial industry, Bain Capital and their extended reach, or whether it's people active in the Mormon Church, or whether it's familiar Republican donors like Bob Perry, who funded the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth against John Kerry, is also stepping up and funding super PACs in this race for Rick Perry, but also for Mitt Romney to some degree now that Rick Perry's not there anymore. So to some degree, the message of the ads itself tells you where they're coming from in a larger sense. And the most important thing is as my colleagues have suggested, fact-checking the message itself.
I want to ask you, John, you got this question this afternoon in the lecture at FSU, somebody wanted to talk about changes at the Wall Street Journal since you were there and the extent to which this reflects what's going on either in politics and media or the world.
The change in the Wall Street Journal began to unfold pre-Murdoch. Murdoch bought the paper in late 2007. And the change was the journal's attempt to adapt itself to the new news environment and the challenging news environment that we live in. The half magazine model, which I grew up on and others did before me and during the time that I was with the journal, where it was a much slower cooking process of some of the main feature stories of the journal. The blessing of that was you had tremendous amount of time to report in depth and to edit well and produce really finely crafted pieces of journalism. But that increasingly became out of step with ways in which newspapers have to maintain audience and maintain their financial viability. So stories were getting shorter and more topical, less detached from the flow of news, and Murdoch has accelerated that. Murdoch wants a big fight with the New York Times, and so he has made the Wall Street Journal into more of a conventional national newspaper. I think there is some loss in that for the distinctive value that the journal of my day, I think, added. But on the other hand, I recognize the business imperatives that he's facing and his aspiration for a big fight with the Times, and he's pursuing it, and so everybody can see it in the newspaper. It looks less distinctive, more like other newspapers, but it might also be more competitive in a direct sense.
I want to turn to Justin, and we haven't talked as much as I might have expected about Fox versus NBC and conservative versus liberal media, but I'd like your take on all of that. We have here in Florida, Newsmax is down in Southeast Florida and is certainly a influential conservative news source. The rise of one in Tallahassee is part of the rise of sort of the new private media covering Tallahassee and state government. And then, of course, the regular Fox, NBC, all those, MSNBC. What do you think?
I like it. I'm a big believer in freedom. I'm a big believer in liberty. I believe that, as I said before in my response to the question about Walter Cronkite, that I think it's a good thing. It doesn't trouble me at all that there are more sources of information. It doesn't trouble me at all that NBC has a certain editorial flavor to it, that Fox has a certain editorial flavor to it, that the St. Pete Times has a certain editorial flavor to it, as the Miami Herald does. I mean, again, from my perspective, as someone who is right of center, from my perspective, much of the media I've consumed through much of my young adult and adult life has been from a left of center perspective. So given that, I am delighted that there's a diversity of perspective out there. It doesn't worry me at all. I know some people are concerned about that, but I think that I think that this concern is a little bit, I don't know, it just seems unusual to me, because I don't remember anyone ever being concerned that people who lived in the Upper East Side of Manhattan were only getting their news from the New York Times. You know, I mean, this is now I think that part of it I interpret as kind of code for, well, geez, now the conservatives have their own news organizations that they can read, like Newsmax or like Fox News, that they can watch, that they never have to get exposed to the other side. But, you know, if there's anyone who's left of center here that has the concern about that, when you get home tonight, before you watch John on CNBC, turn on Fox News and watch Sean Hannity for an hour. You'll feel much better.
Well, when I was in college, which was a long time ago in Nashville, they still had a competing left-leaning Nashville Tennessean and a right-leaning Nashville Banner. And the saying was that you never quite knew what the truth was, but you always knew when there was a fight. How fares it for truth in all of this?
I'm a lawyer, okay? So that may be a good thing.
Well, okay. So you're worse even than the rest
word,
of us.
Right. Truth is a relative word. No, but I mean, if you look at the legal model, and this isn't a perfect model, but the concept is in our justice system, our criminal justice system, our civil justice system is you have a defense, you have a prosecution, and let the two sides fight it out, and somewhere the truth will come out. So, again, I believe in more free speech. I believe in more voices. I think that the truth will come out. I am not someone who believes that we need to have high priests and priestesses figuring out and telling the rest of us what's true or not. I think the internet and the diversity of information, the internet itself is an incredible self-correcting machine. You just heard the editor of the St. Pete Times talk about crowdsourcing. Well, look at what happened with Dan Rather. Dan Rather got taken down by a blogger that had access to the internet who exposed something that he was doing that was not right. Okay, so from that perspective, I think that I'm delighted that there are more people who have more ability to access information than ever before in human history. I think it's a good thing for the truth. If I were to do something that wasn't truthful, or if the St. Pete Times would do something that wasn't truthful, it's not someone from the Tampa Tribune that's going to call them on it. Someone on the internet's going to bring it to their attention. Someone on the internet's going to bring it to my attention. So there's a self-correcting feature. Now, I'm not saying it's perfect, but no system that I'm aware of is perfect. But I think there are millions and millions of editors out there on the internet that are consuming the information, that can post this content lots of times on the newspapers' sites themselves.
Joe, got a response? Comment?
Well, I think the diversity of voices is important. I think most people condition themselves to tune out, unfortunately, the things that they're predisposed not to believe in the first place, and in a way that's unfortunate. I recommend and recommend students, you know, listen to them, you know, watch some Fox and watch MSNBC, read the Times, read the Post, read other sources, but then try to get as much information as you can and figure out where the truth lies. But we're conditioned to follow the sources that we tend to believe already, and I think that's a trend that's going to be with us for some time.
I'm concerned about the absence of a civilness in many of the responses that come online, particularly for those news organizations like ours who let you post without putting your name there. Some of the comments that get posted are just horrible. I mean, we've even had them posted on people's obituaries where they're going in and calling the dead person all kinds of terrible names. And I think the internet, that's one of the negative impacts that the internet brings to us.
Look, you know, I'd love to do a poll. So we've got these comments, right? Everybody sees them online. How many, we're going to have a vote. Yes. How many think they should be anonymous, and how many think you should have to sign your name or something? Everybody who thinks you ought to sign your name to those comments. Woo!
Wow.
Woo! Okay. Let's, anybody for anonymous? Oh, there's my wife. She's for. So you're the one who's been talking about me.
This may
this may reflect the success of a place like Facebook, where almost everyone uses their name. And generally, the discourse on Facebook is more civil than it is on many of the other websites.
Let's do a question. Jack, do you have a question back there? It's not on. There you go.
I think we're okay. I stand as an admirer of all six of you individually and all six of you collectively. But I have a concern, and that concern is the next generation of readers and civic leaders. I recently had the opportunity to be an adjunct in political science at Florida State at the graduate level. And I must tell you, I was underwhelmed about their reading and writing ability. No offense, Professor Ritchie. And I was even more underwhelmed about their knowledge of civics. Only half my class could name one of their U.S. senators, and none could name both. Now, I give you that in personal testimony because kudos to you, Justin. Not only is your site gleaning all of the print materials, et cetera, but you have the easiest access to our governmental systems up and down the row than anyone I've ever seen, and I don't see any newspaper websites that have that easy access, so I recommend that to you, Neil, and to others, easy access to our governmental systems. But my question is directed at each of you is, what are we doing to raise another generation of readers and civic activists, and how do we do that rapidly so we don't lose a generation who are neither involved in reading for pleasure or reading for public policy?
All right, let's just go down the row real quick. Joe, you want to start?
I force them.
I compel my students to read. Unfortunately, I start off with two places that have paywalls, and so I get a little pushback because I want them reading the Times just because it is still, to me, probably the most comprehensive and in-depth source of information, but of national and international in particular. And I want them reading their local paper, so they have to read the Democrat. So we have two paywalls that they have to kind of either buy into or work around. And I've got a colleague who's gotten all of his students to go ahead and buy the online subscription to the New York Times. And as Justin, I think, will attest back there that I give some rather difficult current events quizzes to make sure that they are reading. I'm not always pleased with the answers either, Jack. I mean, you're right on that there's although I don't know if our generation was really that much better at that time. I really don't know if we were. There was a time when I was in college, and yeah, I knew Jerry Ford was my congressman when I was in college, and I knew who he was, but I wasn't always all that clear on the rest of the folks in the Congress, in the House and the Senate. But today there is a real big problem in that area, and I do the same thing. I give my students a list every semester, 200 names of national, local, international figures, most of the leadership of the four houses in Washington and Tallahassee, and people from different walks, judges and educators, even entertainers, 200 names. And at the end of the semester, I expect them to know every one of them and what these folks' particular occupation is and what their role is. And that helps them because they have to read and get a little background. And if they don't know all 200 of those names, their final exam's going to look pretty poor. So
Justin,
compel them.
Justin, you were nodding?
Yeah, well, I was just agreeing that, look, we just know sociologically that young people are not as interested in civic engagement as people that are older. So of those students that didn't know, they couldn't name the two senators, I promise you by the time they're 65 years old, they will be able to name both of their senators. So I think that's just something that they'll get more engaged over time.
They could probably name the halftime performers for the last 10 Super Bowls. I think one thing that all of us could do in our relation to the news is to not focus so much on trivial news. Get serious with what we're reporting and doing. Now, most of us do, but I despair in the mornings when I turn on the news and suddenly it deteriorates into Lindsay Lohan is going to jail again.
Right.
That's not – it's no longer news, for one thing.
Well, we've got a – I thought she was out. Hey, Lucy, I thought she was out.
Maybe you're keeping up better than I am, John.
A couple of people actually in here, there's a question about sort of the effect of social media and the sense of breaking news and how much that diminishes the ability to report something more seriously. And one question, by the way, Justin says, if I tweet tonight using the Safey hashtag, do I get extra points on Florida Guru? So, but what do you think? I mean, is there too much attention? Tweeting, shooting film, doing...
I think it does detract from the time you spend researching and writing a serious news story, if you're a reporter. But I also think we have to do it to keep the news out there.
If I can just quick, on some big breaking stories, those would be extremely helpful. The earthquake in Haiti, there's no way that some of the information that was disseminated there would have gotten out if it hadn't been for a couple of folks tweeting where people were, where destruction was, et cetera, and a lot of lives were saved as a result, too.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think we got to get past this being a choice, okay? I think Twitter in particular is no longer... should be called not mainstream media. Twitter is a form of communication that's just everyday, real, profound, and largely to the good. Everything can be abused. Everything can be a distraction. But I remember talking to our media writer, Eric Deggans, after all the tweets. You know, he tweeted about Bin Laden being killed before, you know, there was any sort. And he said, and he wrote his piece, Twitter beat the mainstream media. Twitter is the mainstream media now, and there should be nothing to be ashamed about in any of it. Obviously, you got to take it further, and that still involves reporting, getting it right. But we shouldn't, you know, sort of mix these things up as if one bad, the other good. In my view, this is how people get their information. They're getting in a real time. To Jack's question, I think I don't think that forcing people to eat their peas, kids or others, is exactly the answer. We've got to come at things in new and creative ways. I mentioned this TBT publication we have in print geared at people from 18 to 40. That's not that young, maybe not kids, but still, they're reading it. They just are not interested in it at 6 o'clock in their driveway. First of all, they don't have a driveway. Second of all, the broadsheet doesn't work for them. Now, does that mean they're only interested in Lindsay Lohan? No, I actually don't think they are. But if you went at how are we going to deal with the environmental impacts of an oil spill, oh, and a guy named Bill Nelson is helping with that, or a guy named Marco Rubio is helping with that, they're going to learn, they're going to come at things in a different way. But I think Facebook, Twitter, even the comments, we're still in a sort of a pioneering stage. It's all evolving, but I don't think we need to be afraid of it. We just need to know there's going to be some trips along the way. Yeah, well, interestingly, still believe in it big time. It's still part of our, we have newspaper in education. It's now increasingly an online endeavor, but every teacher in Pinellas, Hillsborough, Pasco, and Hernando can get it in their classroom. What's more, in addition to the NIE, where you can use the newspaper to teach current events, you don't have to teach about, you know, it should be more organic than we're going to teach you to read a paper. It has to be about what's interesting to you. We still do quite a bit of that, but we also, in the last 2 years, started something called TB2, I'm not sure the name's worth explaining, but it's in every high school. It's print product in every high school in Pinellas and Hillsborough County, produced by students but edited at the St. Pete Times, geared toward topics rather than either geography or a format. And the kids, on Thursdays when it comes, some couldn't give a crap, and some just eat it all up. And it's information about how to get into college, entertainment, local politics, but presented in a way that's more appealing to them rather than telling them, read the newspaper just like your dad did. Sorry to go on.
I just wanted to answer the question that, yes, if you use the Savvy hashtag, you'll get points in Florida Guru tonight.
All right.
And for those who don't know what Florida Guru is, this is a game that we launched in November on our website that is a game for our readers to play, those who are competitive with each other. And there are points, and we have a contest every month, and the top five winners of the game every month get Apple Store gift cards ranging from $50 to $150. And you get points by visiting our page. So if you visit our page, you get points just to come to our home site, to our home page. You get points if you use our hashtag on Twitter. You get points if you retweet one of our tweets that we put out on the internet. If you retweet that tweet to your followers, you get points. And so we have a...
Sounds corrupt to me.
If you...
Justin, would you answer...
If you share a link to the Tampa Bay Times story with all of your friends via email, Twitter, or Facebook, we'll also give you points for doing that. So it's another thing we're trying to do to help drive traffic to the newspapers.
Justin, who makes the decision each morning as to the placement of stories on your... website?
Sure. So for the first 4 years of this, from 2000 to 2006, I woke up every morning at 5:15 in the morning. I read all the state's newspapers. I laid out the page myself, personally published it, put it to bed by 9 o'clock so I could get in the shower and get to work and leave for work by 7:30 in the morning. When I started the site, I had no idea to turn it into a business. I didn't have any concept of making money or generating any revenue from it. I just wanted to do it to serve, to reveal, and to enlighten. And so after 4 years of publishing, it developed a following, and I was being approached by people that wanted to advertise on my site. And the first 4 or 5 times, people said, "Hey, listen, can I buy an ad?" I'm like, "No, I'm not interested. I'm not doing that. That's not why I created the site." And then I think maybe I told my wife this about the fifth time, and she said, "Well, you know, if people want to give you money, you probably ought to figure out a way to take it." So I started selling advertising. The reason this is important to answering your question is once I started selling advertising, then I was able to hire people who are my article editors, who now wake up at 5:15 in the morning instead of me. And so they do it, and then they send me an email when they're finished clipping all the articles, posting on the page. I log in around 6:55, 7 a.m. in the morning. I look at how they've laid out the articles. I'm the final page editor. So I'm the front page editor of the site, and then I publish it right around between 7 and 7:10.
Okay. I want to get two quick questions for the audience, and if you'll tell the one person you want to answer it.
Well, actually, it's a point first. I mean,
okay.
Justin, I too am a lawyer, but I truly believe that the truth is the truth. You know, whether we have spinning by lawyers or otherwise, there still is a truth. And that's the point of my question. I'm one of those readers of papers who I read, and I want to know as much as I can by way of facts. I want to know, when I read Fox, I know what I'm getting. When I read MSNBC, I know what I'm getting. My concern is the papers that want to be balanced appear to be balanced. So what they do is they take facts and strong arguments and factually supported arguments, and they almost put them on balance with weak arguments that aren't supported by fact, that are theoretical. So that annoys me, that to try and appear balanced, they don't give facts, and they don't give it the right, you know, the strength of the arguments. Now I'm concerned, too. Now, PolitiFact, I love it. And the Pinocchio's of PolitiFact, I love it. I love to read it because that's where I do go and hope that I'm going to get facts. My concern, though, is now that I'm watching and this is becoming more, you know, commonplace, are we seeing the same kind of thing where those PolitiFacts are trying to be balanced? Because now, as long as they've been around for a while, we're seeing annual reports that say, here's what we did in the past and here's who's been hit with Pinocchio's and here's who hasn't been. But when you look at relative-wise and substantive-wise, it's kind of nonsensical. So that's my concern. Are we going to go that way with PolitiFact now?
Well, it's a great question. I hope not, obviously. One thing when we created PolitiFact, we actually said we're not going to do a quota deal where if you do 5 Democrats, you got to do 5 Republicans. It's all going to be about picking a good – something that we could be checked and that couldn't just be written off to political hyperbole or rhetoric or something like that. And over time, we figured that balance issue will just sort of work itself out. So right now, believe me, we never meet and sort of say, gee, we had 3 Democrats last week, time for 3 Republicans. We just don't go there. They all, in a sense, have to stand on their own. And you'll just have to sort of judge it on time. We're very sensitive to that notion. As we work with our partners, there was an instinct, well, if we said this, we have to say this. That's not what it's about. This is also why we lay out all our sources. And you can ultimately decide. We do our truthometer. We come up with a rating, true, false, whatever it may be. That's our rating. You can have your own rating. It's up to you. You get to decide. We're not trying to tell you. But based on our reporting, here's what we did. But we're very careful to not go with any kind of quota system whatsoever. So when we sometimes collect them, it's just we have to be careful. Since we don't check every fact, because you couldn't possibly, and sometimes, you know, we can't even find the ad, something like that, we just have to sort of say, of the things we checked on this guy, Romney, Obama, whatever it is, here's what we found. There is an element that every one of you has to take some ownership for your own being a consumer of information, and we have to put some of that on you.
And I just want to say one thing too. I don't mean to suggest that the truth isn't the truth. The truth is obviously the truth, and we could have an interesting Socratic dialogue about what truth is. But I think that the best way to find truth is through a free and fair exchange and an open exchange of ideas. That's more likely to generate truth than if you have a small handful of people trying to decide for the rest of us what truth is.
Let me go to a question. Let me just make one brief postscript. I think there's a lot of merit to the argument that Justin has been making tonight. I would say, though, my concern is that there are many people out there who don't have time to consume the yin and yang of the two sides. And further, there are many people who don't get to the yin after getting the yang. So, you know, they may only pursue they may only consume part from one of the sources in this sort of dialectic that he was positing. And the problem is a lot of that stuff is principally driven by entertainment value and not by the actual sort of substantive analysis of what the reality is. And I hope that function is not lost. I get the diversity of opinion, and I agree that that's a beneficial thing, but for the interest of what I do and what I'm trying to achieve in journalism, which is to give people understanding and meaning and perspective of events, I hope we can maximize the space for that function independently.
And in fact, Google algorithms are actually giving us more and more of what we click on first, which makes what you're talking about even worse. And Mr. Moderator, can I beg for two questions? We have two people who've been waiting very, very patiently.
Yeah, and then I'm going to come back. John, you can get the last question to talk about that, and then we'll go. So,
and this is the next generation asking a question.
This is the next generation, so.
All right, this is from Mr. Harwood, and it kind of goes with what you were saying. So with now that information is so instantaneous, and especially with my generation, when you can really choose through what you're looking at, even though there isn't a dominant information source, you can really choose what you're looking at. So will my generation be more open-minded, more choosing a little bit from each source, or will we be more completely what we already thought and more focused on what we already want to know about?
Can't know for sure. I hope it's the former and not the latter. I will say that I think it is inherent in the nature of young people as they set out on their own sort of journey in life that they are going to be open-minded and they're going to be sort of molded by their experience and the interplay of their experience and the information they take in. I have more of a concern with people who develop fixed ideas later in life and then never don't change any and aren't open to new information. But I think the danger of the polarization of media, which tracks polarization in politics, is that the silos that we all exist in get harder and harder. And I hope that there are forces in the business that have the effect of breaking down those silos.
Okay, one more question. You got, is that it? Oh, great, you got it.
Hi, my name is Tabitha Frazier, and I'm a local grassroots organizer, and I have the opportunity to work with a lot of young people. And I have to say that I think this generation is very engaged and very aware of what's happening, more so than a generation even a decade ago. But they are a little bit cynical of newspapers because they feel that they are biased by either their owners or their advertisers. And I've heard a lot of talk from college students about a website called Reddit.com. And the concept of Reddit.com is anyone can submit a paper on there, whether it's your master's thesis, a newspaper article, and they'll categorize it by subject, and it's read by anyone, and they click on it based on opinion. So you go to Reddit.com, and at any time, the front page of their paper is the most popular read article. People write opinions, and I know a lot. I'm on Facebook. I'm a huge person, and I had noticed that they weren't reading the traditional media, and they feel that this is the source. Are you familiar with the site, and do you feel that this could be the future of journalism?
Who would you like to answer?
Anyone.
Fielder's choice.
I'll go for it. Okay. I'm not. I think I've heard of this site, but I've not been on it. Again, I'm big on lots of choices, not either ors. The thing that concerns me about what you describe in terms of the site is there's a difference between just putting information out there, even well-intended, well-written information, and journalism, where we are trying, in fact, to report it independently and synthesize it. I don't dismiss for a second that maybe a traditional media isn't appealing to some members of a younger audience, and so I don't mean to dismiss this at all. But I think editing, making choices, bringing independent judgment and independent reporting to the information still can't be dismissed. And if that's not working for a lot of young people, we still have to come up with new options beyond what you're describing. For instance, the very papers you're describing, what if half of that information is inaccurate? Whose name is behind it? I think that we should be willing to sort of say journalism is a thing. It doesn't mean it's the only thing, but it's a thing, and it involves credibility, reporting, showing your work. And I don't think the answer is to give up on that. I also agree the answer shouldn't be that that's exclusively the only way we ought to get information.
I'm going to give the last question to John and really sort of make it the benedictory comment of the evening. Before I ask that question, I just want to thank all of you for coming, to thank Laird and Flo, if they are still here, for being partners in this. And the School of Social Science, is David Rasmussen still here? And thanks to all of you. Thanks to our panel, Joe Ritchie, Justin Safey, Neil Brown. It's been a great evening, and I thank you all for doing this. John, somebody wanted you to answer the question that you were asked at the end this afternoon, which is, what is the role of the journalist in the 21st century?
Well, I'll say from my perspective that the role that I've absorbed psychically and try to live out in my work, it derives from having watched my dad in his career. My dad covered a lot of big events during the 1960s and the 1970s, civil rights movement, Vietnam, Watergate, and I developed the idea from him that he was at the center of important events, that journalism was an exciting place to learn and share information. And when I heard him talk, I thought that the grasp that he had of what was happening, his ability to explain it and understand it, was something that I wanted to achieve in my own life. And so now that we've gotten to the point that we're in journalism, where journalists are less than ever before the conveyors of first impression, or at least Twitter, being the best example, is more than anything else right now the deliverer of first impression of discrete news events. Like, people learn that X happened, X bill passed, the Giants beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl, or any other discrete set of facts. But what the journalist can do, and what I aspire to do, is to try to give some meaning and understanding of people of what those facts are, why they happened, what they tell us about our culture and our society, what they suggest about where things may be going in the future. And to me, that is the value that journalism can add, and that I hope we do add, because I do think, as Neil was suggesting, journalism is a thing, and I think there is a hunger by people for information that they can trust. And there have to be people with experience and strong values and credibility and character and intelligence with the ability to get beneath the surface of events and make this world a little bit more comprehensible to people than before they consume that information. And for me, that is the mission that I carry around for journalism, and that I hope for the whole business.
And with that, we'll say good night.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to all of you.
Thank you.